these are devices or interfaces with the surface of the brain, and they can actually either record, which is what we did, but they can also stimulate.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the X-Health Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. We're meeting today on Campus Biotech, the world-class neuroscience hub in the picturesque Lake Geneva region in Switzerland. My guest, Dr. Nicolas Vachicouras, is a microengineer fascinating with micro-nanotechnologies for interfaces with the nervous system. Boldly enough, he knew he wants to found a startup even before his PhD. Neurosoft Bioelectronics work on soft brain electrodes that act as implantable brain-computer interface. They started with soft ECOG, tested now for epilepsy, and soft tinnit to provide relief in severe tinnitus. You'll hear about recording from the brain, sending messages to the brain, epilepsy and stopping drug-resistant seizures, severe tinnitus or ringing in the ears, the science of making rigid materials stretchable, and why we're speaking about panna cotta brain. Nicolas, so the first patient has just had your implant inserted. How was the day?
Yeah, so it was end of June. In Houston, in Texas. So actually, we were told this only 4 days before the surgery. So we had to get the tickets very last minute with my co-founder, Ludovic. And we brought the implants there. So the neurosurgeon, so we knew him already quite well. We had already showed him the devices. We had been discussing, you know, the details of the shape and et cetera. But it was still the first time he was going to use it for real, and like he had only touched it, whereas some other people we work with usually would have tested in cadavers or animals. So we went there in the morning, and we're waiting for the moment. So the idea here, just to understand the context, is that the patient has epileptic seizures, and so they are removing parts of the brain that causes the seizures, to make it simple. And so the idea was to take advantage of the surgery to test our electrodes and to test the ability of our device to record brain activity. So it takes a lot of time actually to open up the skull and get to the point where the brain is exposed. And at one point they decide to test the electrodes. And so it was a very stressful day for myself because, well, there was a lot of unknowns. So the first one, electrically speaking, these devices can easily pick up noise from the environment. So meaning that the signal can easily be blurred just by having interactions with, you know, phones, equipment, etc. So that was a main stress: is it going to work properly in terms of being able to record the activity of the brain without interfering with the environment? Because we had never tested it there. So that was the first one. And then, you know, small details: how do you connect? You know, making sure the surgeon puts it the right way on the brain, making sure that the cables are connected correctly. So all of these things were a bit stressful, but in the end, we were quite happy because, you know, as soon as we plugged it in, we were able to see the signals of the brain and it was good quality. And so that was very reassuring overall. The other thing that is for me very stressful is because we make the implants ourselves. So obviously we've been spending the last 4 years putting in place a manufacturing facility to make sure that everything is properly done. We control what we call bioburden, making sure that there's no anything that could generate infections. We had, of course, sterilized the devices. We had, tried to validate everything we could beforehand.
I saw the picture with some guys in spacesuits.
Yes, exactly. So that's in a cleaner environment. So actually, it's a great environment to make medical devices because the main way bacteria or anything could go on the device is through dust. And the main thing in these clean rooms is that we control the particles in the air. So that works quite well. And actually, our devices are already quite clean out of production, even before being sterilized. Of course, you know, they're not sterile per se. But so for me, that was a lot of the stress during surgery. But of course, these are the type of things you only see a few days after if the patient has an infection or something. So Overall, I would say after seeing that the device worked properly and was recording with a good signal quality, that was already a huge relief. Of course, the first 2 days always a bit stressful. You want to make sure you don't receive a phone call from the hospital or et cetera.
So you stayed there in Houston?
So we were there, but it was not, we didn't have to. It's just that we were there also to debrief. But we were already, I mean, we were quite sure about that aspect. The main part I was not 100% sure is, again, the signal quality and not having noise. So as soon as we finished the surgery, it was a big relief. And we went to have a brisket, as we should have in Houston.
Yeah. How long did it last?
So the surgery was very long. It took, we were not even there for the start, but we were there for 4 or 5 hours.
So it was still the resection surgery?
Yes.
It was, okay,
yes.
As planned, plus
exactly.
Your implant.
Plus tested the electrode, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so overall it lasted the entire surgery 4 or 5 hours. Now, the time that we used our electrode to record from the brain was about 20 to 30 minutes. We tested it at different points and we either recorded what we call spontaneous activity, so just without any stimuli. And this is typically where you can see some epileptic activity from some brain regions. And then we also did some specific tasks where we send sound into the operating room, even though the patient is anesthetized. We send speech. And we recorded from the auditory cortex. So we could kind of basically record what the patient was hearing, specifically for speech.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
When unconscious.
Yes. It's always surprises, but then you remember that even when you sleep, if your alarm goes off, you wake up.
Right.
Yeah. So you still have brain activity when you hear, even if you're anesthetized.
Okay. So now yeah. We approach a bit this,
yeah.
Why it is called brain computer interface.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you see it on the computer?
How do you see it?
Yes.
Yeah. So actually it looks like a signal, like a wave that evolves with time. And what you typically see, at least in our case, we have electrodes on the surface of the brain. So every electrode, it's 1 millimeter diameter, so it's quite small, but it covers, hundreds of thousands of neurons. And so when these neurons are activated, you will record what we call a local field potential. So it's basically the sum of all the activity of the neurons. And so basically, based on where the electrode is, some neurons are more activated than others. So, for example, in the auditory cortex, if you think of sound, the sound has different frequencies. So you have low frequencies, high frequencies, and some parts of the brain will be more active if the sound comes from a high frequency or low frequency component. And so really what you see is just the activity of the brain as a wave on the computer.
And how I believe you need to learn how to read that, or the fascinating thing is also, like you said, you send speech to the brain and then you activate it, like you said, which part of cortex?
So it's auditory
cortex.
So we don't, basically it's just sound, huh? Mm-hmm. When we send to the, it's just, we just have a speaker that sends sound at the operating room and then we just record the activity of the brain in response to that.
Okay.
But
you see which part is activated?
So you can see which electrodes have more activity than others, for example.
Okay.
But then again, visually you can see the signals, but again, you need to do a lot more in-depth analysis that you can do offline later down the road, to really try to, for example, one of the objectives would be to decode what the patient hears just by looking at the brain signals. That, for example, but this requires a lot more, signal processing and machine learning that is done, I would say, afterwards.
Okay, so the implant, you just tested with this patient?
Yeah, exactly.
Or is it implanted in
the patient? So we just tested it for the first step. So that was step one, is just to see that the device can record in a operating room setting, making sure that we have good quality signals. And next year, we want to start leaving it for longer periods of time, of course.
All right, so let's maybe have a step back.
Yes.
And could you say, of course, you're not a doctor, I'm not a doctor, but you know why you manufacture what you manufacture. So could you tell, what are the options for, epileptic patient now, when they have some seizures that are basically, I believe, uncontrollable anymore, right?
Yeah, so the main treatment that patients go through, if possible, is through drugs. So they take different type of drugs to try to stop the seizures. And statistically, about two-thirds of patients respond quite well to drug treatment. But there's one-third of patients who do not respond to drug treatment. So we call
them... One-third is quite a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. It's still a lot. So it's, they are called drug-resistant epilepsy. And these are the patients where, at that point, there's... People try other alternatives, and I would say one of the most common ones, if possible, is to remove actually the part of the brain that causes a seizure. So it's really what we call a resection. And within this context, to remove the part of the brain that causes a seizure, well, you need to make sure you know which part of the brain causes a seizure. So ideally, you try to figure it out non-invasively. So for example, with an fMRI or with electrodes just on the head, really on the scalp, try to pinpoint where the seizure comes from. Like this, when you open up, you can immediately remove the part of the brain that causes seizure. But often it's not possible. You need to put an actual electrode on the brain to localize where the seizure comes from. And so this is where these type of devices come in play.
What kind of devices are available now?
So today, one of the ways that is used a lot are electrodes that, again, go on the surface of the brain, but they are made of very rigid materials. So they're made of metal, platinum, actually, discs that are embedded in a relatively thick silicone substrate. And these devices are used to localize seizures by, again, recording the brain activity during seizures.
So what does it take to implant them?
So it's the same type of approach. So again, you open up and then the skull, and then you put the electrodes on the surface of the brain and you close up and you attach it to a system that the computer that records the activity during the seizure, basically.
And the patient, so you, I'm just curious if this happens, like, so the patients go home with this implant,
no.
Or everything happens in the operating room?
It's not surprising, but patients are basically remain at the hospital for 1 or 2 weeks, and with the cables literally coming out of their skull, connected to this computer, and the goal during these 1 or 2 weeks is to have a few seizures, and during the seizure, while the seizure is happening, based on the activity that they can record from the electrodes, is to pinpoint where the seizure comes from.
But basically, the skull is opened twice, at least, right?
Yes, in that case, exactly. So they open up, but the electrodes close again, wait, and then they reopen to do the seizure resection. So that's how they use these type of electrodes.
Oh, what can be the side effects?
So in this case... Well, the main problem is, again, risk of infection. If you have a huge craniotomy, you always have a risk of having an infection that appears. And then with the electrodes themselves, I would say there's two main issues potentially. One is what we call hematomas. So, for example, you have blood vessels all over the surface of the brain. So if, especially on curved parts of the brain, you have a higher risk of the electrode pushing on the blood vessel, it can break and it can cause bleeding, which is what we call a subdural hematoma. So that's one risk. The other one is just what we call mass effect, where basically the implant just pushes the brain. It's quite impressive, actually. You can have brains that are completely squashed just by having the electrodes, even if it's only for a few weeks.
Oh, so you told me you saw them for the first time when you were, I don't remember, a master's student or a PhD student. What did you think about them at the time?
I was surprised of how old school technology it was. Like, if you look into really details, it's not something impressive. Like, it's just a disc, and when you look at it, it's not even cut properly. It was very crude. But then I realized that a lot of medical devices, are usually made by hand, and they're, very simple in how they are made.
So how does your solution differ? So that's called soft ECOG. That's what we are speaking about now.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I have some here, you can see, but the main idea is that the electrodes are, so first of all, we use what we call elastic materials. So it's the idea that you can stretch them.
Yeah. It looks like some, okay. So it's like
silicone.
A jelly tape. It's like funny feeling.
Yes.
It's like real gentle.
It's like a rubber band.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so I have one that is smaller, one that is bigger.
Exactly.
So one is, is it 5 centimeters long, like 1.5 centimeters wide? would that be? And the other is about 8, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's 8. And 2.5 centimeters wide.
Exactly.
Are there different types?
Yeah. So we basically, well, there's a few things we can change. First of all, the thickness. That's one important parameter. So these devices, well, first of all, I was very surprised when I started measuring the devices on the market, but they have a very non-uniform thickness. It can vary from 1 millimeter to 2 millimeter within the same device. So we have a pretty uniform thickness, but they're very thin. So here you have like 400 microns, so 0.4 millimeters. This one is 0.6 millimeters. So already having something thinner is a bit less invasive on the brain. And the other aspect is indeed we can change the shape of the electrode. We can make the full device much bigger. And also the electrode sites, so which is really the dot that records. As you can tell here, you have like 32 large electrodes. So these are 2 millimeter diameter. These ones here, you have 60 on a much smaller surface. And every dot is like 300 micrometers in diameter.
So why one is bigger from the other?
So it all depends about what you want to do and where you're going. So the idea here is that this was initially made for an animal. This is
the smaller one.
The smaller one. This one we had basically copied the exact dimensions of devices in the clinic today, which are about 2.3 millimeter diameter. And so we did the same, but in soft and stretchable.
So it's more gentle on the brain.
I mean, to be honest, the reason why people have these large diameters on the market today is, again, they do it by hand. So a lot of the manufacturing process, so they're not able to manufacture high-density electrodes. So this has been a big trend in our space, in our technologies, to make smaller electrodes. But again, this means you need to change the way you manufacture them. And so this is not necessarily what we want. Is this what they had? And again, as we are making our steps into the market, we need to be able to compare things that are comparable. So in our case, in Houston, this is the one we tested. So it's slightly bigger than this one, but still smaller than these ones. So they are 1 millimeter diameter.
So I'm just like thinking, is it like one sixth of the regular one? So the one available now on the market?
Yeah. I mean, the market has a lot of them. So this is one, but it's an interesting market. It's like you have a lot of different type of grids, and it always depends on what you want to record from. So if you want to record from one part of the brain, you might put two grids or one strip in another grid. So it really is kind of like a puzzle. And usually these patients with epilepsy, they know in advance, obviously before the surgery. So based on MRIs, they can decide, okay, these are the electrodes we're going to use and we're going to put them here and there. So we also are obliged to have a wide range of possible devices that can be used. So it really depends on per patient where you want to go and what you want to do.
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The Exhale Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't, please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode.
So do you usually, or do surgeons usually place one of these implants, or do they, can they use a couple or three of them?
Yeah. So typically for epilepsy, it all depends on how sure they are in which general direction the seizure comes from.
So they've seen an MRI, so they have some idea.
Yeah. So if they know, but sometimes they have no idea. Sometimes they know the hemisphere, so then they only have to cover the first one hemisphere, or they know it's a temporal lobe, but they still have to cover. So, but typically, I would say they would have one or two grids and three or four strips.
And then, I'm just like thinking still about this first patient. Like, did you see him or her after the surgery?
No. We didn't see them. So we only saw during the surgery, basically.
Okay. So we spoke about epilepsy. Mm-hmm. What diseases can these implants or this ECOG, soft ECOG, support?
I mean, at the end of the day, what we're building is a bit more generic than just epilepsy. These are devices or interfaces with the surface of the brain. And they can actually either record, which is what we did, but they can also stimulate, some sending an electrical shock that can activate neurons and then generate an effect, like a pacemaker.
Okay, like for example, what in what circumstances you can use or what condition?
Yeah, so for example, I would say one of the most common devices that do that is on the spinal cord, where you basically send pulses of current continuously to block signals from the pain. So you have people with chronic back pain that suffer a lot. And by just putting an electrode and stimulating constantly, you're able to block the signal of the pain and it's a relief. So that's an example of how electrical stimulation can be used to alleviate pain. Another example in the brain, it's not surface, it's penetrating. So it's a target really in the middle of the brain. It's called the subthalamic nucleus. It's for Parkinson's. You can stimulate. And if you send these signals, you can actually have incredible effects where patients who are shaking will stop shaking immediately as you activate the electrodes. So these are just two common examples, but you can think of it, if I stimulate the auditory cortex, I can generate sound hallucinations. If I stimulate electrically the visual cortex, you will start seeing flashes of lights on your...
Yeah, this part is actually kind of scary.
Yes. You know? But voilà,
so. We're entering a bit, I mean, something that we knew from science fiction, right?
Yes.
That we can, well, control the brain. But this is actually a control for, well, healing processes?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the of course, you can do a lot of things, but today, all of the applications are to either give back something that was lost from the patient, so blindness, deafness, or neurological disorders. But then, you know, it goes a bit deeper, like people are looking into electrical stimulation for depression, for example. But at the end of the day, the brain controls everything. So when you ask, you know, what diseases you can do, I would say in theory, it's unlimited in the sense that you control everything. Now, we are specifically focusing on electrodes that are surface, so we can only access the cortex. So, of course, the cortex is a big part of the brain. There's a lot happening, but we are not aiming at, for now at least, to target deeper regions in the brain. So, for example, if we take back the example of Parkinson's, where the target is in the middle of the brain, we cannot go there. But everything that touches to the cortex, in theory, is something that we can look into.
So we actually didn't speak about like how do you place it or like how the surgeon places it. Where does he or she place it?
So what's interesting is that for all people, even though we're all very different, the different parts of the brain, they're quite common. So we always know that the motor cortex is in a certain location or the auditory cortex. So typically, anatomically, we have a very good idea of what part of the brain does what. And this is very common across all humans. And so then the idea is that, and this is where there's a lot of different approaches. With the first version of our electrodes, it's a very simple where you remove the skull, you remove the dura. So the dura is a protective layer that is around, think of it like a small skin around the brain that you also remove, and you put the electrode on the surface of the brain. And if you want to keep it there and implant it, then you would put back the dura on top.
You stitch it somehow?
Exactly. Or, yeah. And then you stitch the cables to the dura, and then you can close back the skull. That's the approach. Now, it's very invasive. And one of the things we're working on with our technology is, as you can tell, they're very easy to fold.
Right.
Without breaking them. And that goes back to the definition of elastic materials. And so one of the things we did a proof of concept recently in animals, and we want to do it in humans now, is instead of having to do a big opening on the skull, you just do a small hole, and we call it a burr hole, and you can just deploy the electrodes on the surface of the brain.
So you basically have an idea where do you want to place it.
Exactly. And then you just do the opening where you want.
Oh, that's a huge difference.
Yes.
From opening the whole skull
exactly.
to just having a burr hole.
Yes. So if you look into neurotech or invasive neurotech, there's been a huge trend towards minimally invasive, basically. Because one of the biggest issues with these surgeries, even for epilepsy, and the reason why a lot of patients do not want to necessarily undergo these type of surgeries, is because you have to do a huge opening in the skull. So we want to leverage these electrodes to do minimally invasive. And I think that's really a big trend in general in medicine. You know, if I tell you I have to do a small hole for a surgery instead of opening up the entire heart, for example, it's a bit more attractive also for the patient.
Yeah, so I mean, with knees, we have laparoscopy, for example. And before we were like opening the kneecap.
Exactly.
I think the surgeons right? We used to do that.
Yeah, so it's not only less scary, but it also reduces infection risks if you have a smaller opening. The other advantage is patients recover much quicker, so they're out of the hospital faster. And then also just aesthetically, you have smaller scars. So there's a lot of benefits from doing minimally invasive surgeries.
I'm just like thinking, could you tell a bit more about what is this elastic material?
Yeah.
And like, how did you think about, I mean, did you create it or like developed it, or you took it from, you know, somewhere else? Yeah. How did you match it with the brain?
Yeah.
And also like, I'm very curious to hear like, what is the brain from your perspective?
Yeah.
So from a microengineer perspective?
No, so it's a good question. So for us, the lab where I did my PhD and where I had started also a project for my master's, the whole rationale is to look at the brain from a mechanical perspective. And the analogy I often use is like, it's like jello or panna cotta or tofu. So something very, very, very soft. So that's how you can look at it from a purely mechanical perspective. Of course,
so we have some jellies in our heads.
Exactly. No, but it is a very good analogy of what the texture looks like. So it's quite obvious, like if you're going to put something like jello and then put a metal disc on it long term, it's going to create friction and it's going to generate issues. It's going to, you know, it can, you know, penetrate the brain. It generates what you call scar tissue. So there's a lot of issues coming from there. So what we're doing actually is not, we don't match the mechanical properties of the brain itself, because we do not penetrate the brain, but we are trying to match the mechanical properties of the dura. So the dura, this is kind of skin or layer around the brain.
Huh, and you want to be like dura?
The dura? Because at the end of the day, we are between the dura and the brain. So we're kind of replacing the dura, if you think about it. We're
okay.
Not, because the brain is naturally with the dura. So actually, in the research, the first time we published our work in 2015 with these technologies, we called it e-dura, so electronic dura matter, because this is really what we're replacing. We're, mechanically speaking, the implant is on top of the brain instead of the dura. So that's how we thought about it. And this is why these elastic materials are much closer to the mechanical properties of the dura. There's also been a lot of work in vitro with cell cultures of neurons, where people have shown that cells are very sensitive to the mechanical environment. So we know that cells, you know, the mechanics of what they are touching is very important in terms of how they're going to develop and if they're going to react to it or not. So these are the elements that motivated us to work on what we call elastic materials. And what elastic is, I think the easiest way to explain it is it's something that is not only flexible, because people often talk about flexible, but that piece of paper is flexible. The main difference is that the material can be deformed without changing. So if you take a paper and you scratch it, even if you unfold it, you're going to still see all these creases. So this is like what we could talk about, like plastic deformation.
But also you can cut yourself with a paper.
You can also cut yourself, exactly. So these materials are intrinsically much softer. And as you can see, not only I can fold them, but I can pull them and they go back to their initial mechanical structure.
So if you fold them, may I just interrupt you for a moment here? If you fold them and, well, place them somewhere in the sulci, would they have like the same properties as if you would just spread them there, like on the brain?
It doesn't change how they are. So that's the whole point. So the substrate is nothing new. We didn't invent this material. It's an elastic material that already exists, that is used in medical devices. But
where is it used?
So actually, silicone can be used to coat devices or for breast implants or other type of materials. But typically it will be done in a much thicker way. We process them in a very, very different way. No one makes, you know, thin elastic materials like this in medical devices. Usually they mold them into big pieces for screws or stuff like that. But the problem is not the mechanical part, it's the electrical part, because we have conductors here. And as you probably know, conductors like metals are not elastic. Like if you take an aluminum foil, if you stretch it, it's going to rip. So a lot of the innovation behind the technology is to develop electrical conductors
that are stretchable.
Huh. So that was a lot of the work that I did during my PhD, to work on ways of making conductors stretchable that basically can be stretched without breaking, basically.
Okay, any insights into that? Could you share anything about that? Like, how do you even approach that?
There's different ways. I think the easiest way to explain it is, like, you know, for telephones, old school telephones, where you have this kind of swirly part that you can pull.
Yeah, like a cable, right?
Exactly. So that's one of the idea, is that by having these type of structures, you can kind of pull on it and they can deform in 3D, but even if the cable itself is unstretchable, the structure can still stretch without breaking it. So that's the concept in general. So in our case, it's a bit more complicated than that, but we deposit gold on this silicone. So this is elastic material. And if you do it in the right way, it will form some very small micro cracks, if you want to call them, that when you pull, they, instead of breaking, they kind of deflect out of plane. And so the local stress is lower than what you apply, so it doesn't actually break. So it's kind of magical, but it's really...
Science.
Science, yeah, exactly. So it's...
Microengineering.
So that's one idea. But in general, it's really about having out-of-plane movements that allow you to still stretch in one direction without breaking it.
You mentioned gold here.
Yes.
Like, what materials you knew you can't use on the brain? Yeah. Or like, what were you thinking of? What were you testing?
So actually, the material that is touching the brain is not gold. In our case, it's platinum. So platinum has been historically the most commonly used material for implants for the brain. The main motivation behind it has been corrosion. So as you can imagine, the brain, there's a lot of corrosive liquids, like you have a cerebrospinal fluid, you have a lot of things happening. And if you have a metal that is always wet and you have current flowing through it, as you can imagine, it can very easily corrode. So platinum is one of the materials that corrodes the least easily. It still corrodes, but the least. So this is historically, there's a lot of data with platinum. And when you make a medical device, one of the first rules is that ideally, if you don't need to reinvent new materials, it makes your life much easier because you have prior literature and prior work saying, okay, platinum is safe. So actually, we the dots you see here are made of platinum.
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode. How did you test it? I mean, I'm just thinking again about this first surgeon and how did you convince him or her to use your implant? Mm-hmm. So I am sure you used some research. Yeah, how did you test that before?
We've done a lot of testing in animals in the past. So we have, we had tested these devices on the spinal cord, the brain of a lot of animals, rats, pigs, monkeys. So we've done a lot of this work. I would say one of the main reasons, it goes back to what you're just saying, is that all the materials we use are very well known. So everything that is in contact with the brain of the patient is silicone, medical grade silicone that is you buy on the market, and platinum. So that's what's very nice about this technology, is that we don't have any fancy new materials that no one knows what is the long-term effects. And so I think that was the main aspect of it, saying, look, at the end of the day, these are known materials that have been used for a very, very long time.
And then you tested them here in Geneva, or... like, what were the universities you cooperated with, or did you do it by yourself, your team?
Yeah, so a lot of the work behind the technology was obviously during when we were at the university, so at EPFL, so in Lausanne and Geneva. So a lot of the work we have in animals was done in Switzerland indeed, and the different models of animals, exactly.
So you had the labs there at the university, these were university labs, basically, that's the question.
Exactly, yes, exactly.
Okay, who was this first surgeon? Like, why did he sign up? Did you know him or her before? Could you, yeah, tell a bit about, the, you know, like the first adopter or like really the first person who used it?
So what's interesting is that he was not the first surgeon we've been working on. Actually, we've been working a lot more with people here in Geneva who have helped us a lot, doing a lot of the animal work, cadaver, designing the devices, etc. Really, the thing that changed there was just the regulations. In the US and the hospitals, the process of going through the ethics committee was much easier and faster, I would say, than in Europe. So that was really the factor. Now, how we met Professor Nitin Tandon, so he's the one who was a neurosurgeon, is he wrote a paper a few years ago where he had used these rigid electrodes that I was talking to you about. And he had shown that if you make cuts in these devices, they conform better to the brain and you have less side effects.
So you cut it into pieces and then you basically spread them.
So they're still in one piece, but you make slits in it so they can bend more easily. And he was showing that by doing this, you have less risk of, as I said before, hematomas, etc. And so he's like, well, you know what? Actually, we contacted him, said, well, we actually are making materials that don't need to be cut. They're naturally soft. And
so you've read his paper.
Exactly. So I read his paper. That's how we contacted him. And then we were lucky that he is a neurosurgeon who is doing a lot of clinical research. So he works a lot on brain-computer interfaces, especially for speech. So in general, he was already prone to, you know, testing new technologies and doing a lot of clinical research. So he was extremely motivated to test our electrodes and also to work long-term with him so we could develop also things that he's interested in his work. So that's how it started.
What questions did he have?
So his main interest is speech, brain-computer interfaces. So for people who are, for example, unable to communicate, to allow them to communicate with the environment just by thinking and then retranscribing their thoughts on speech to patients. So I would say that's a very common application for brain-computer interfaces. So that's his main interest in research. So I think it was a good match in the sense that it was his paper, that's how we met, and then he was someone who, you know, enjoys testing new technologies, etc. And so that's how the connection was made. And so he really encouraged us to, and he helped us out with the process. And also his team was really great. It's at the end of the day, it's always about the people. It was the people, but also I have to say the regulations in the US in general are much more attractive today than in Europe, where it's unnecessarily very complicated in Europe. So that was really the...
How unnecessarily? Like when can you actually test it in Geneva?
So I hope early next year, but we're
thinking something like 6 months from now.
I hope so. Because again, it's a lot of documentation is required and the process is quite slow. Also with the competent authorities, the ethics committee. So it's just a slower process.
So all the like organizations, institutions, on the way, they need time to take the decision. Is that what we
there's one
speaking
thing,
about?
But they also ask a lot more documentation than what we had to do in the US.
But do you have to like work on that documentation? I mean,
yes.
do you have to have new tests or like new anything, or you just need to, prepare documents?
It's both. So some tests, but also some documents, for example. Yeah, so there's a lot of work to be done on documentation, I would say, and having a certain format and certain things that they require. So yeah, it's quite heavy. And also now you might be aware, but there's a new medical device regulation.
No, definitely.
Europe.
Everyone is aware in the startup community
exactly.
Here in Europe about that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's they even increase the requirements or what are the required documents. So everything takes a lot more time.
I will be returning to these surgeons' questions because I'm still curious, if there are surgeons interested in implementing new technologies, what would they ask you, like the first thing? And then, you know, what would they want from you or what would they require from you to be a reliable partner, basically?
Yeah. I mean, it always depends on what you're doing. So I think if I have to think of all the contacts we've had with surgeons and neurologists the past few years, and there's a lot. In our specific field, one of the questions that comes up a lot is what designs can we do with the electrodes? As you can see here, just here I have like four different type of designs, how small the electrodes are, how far apart they are. So a lot of the questions are always about how dense can you make them? Again, these are questions mostly for clinical research. So this is typically the question. And then I think, you know, having something that is more attractive that can make things faster. So for example, this deployment system, I think is a very attractive idea because it changes completely the way they use these devices, but it makes it better. You know, it's safer for the patient, faster recovery time. So at the end of the day, you know, all these type of things are the parts that interest
But
doctors.
Then I'm just thinking here, well, they need to learn a new way of approaching the brain.
Yes. And so this is where you need to find partners who are willing to do this journey with you and who have the patience to, you know, take the steps with you, because it's not going to work the first time. Even now, we did our first device and we already, you know, pinpointed some small aspects that we can improve on the electrode, and we're working on the second iteration. So it's extremely important for us to have clinical partners who understand that it's an iterative process and that are willing, you know, to take the time to give the feedback and work on it and not lose patients on the way.
Will they be, because now it's still work in progress, right?
Yes.
Will they be custom made for each patient, or will they be, you know, like normalized?
It's a good question. So in practice, I would say there's some type of grids that are very common, and I would say we would also make always. And then we do have the possibility to have custom made devices within a certain range. So we have what we call design rules, but ideally, We have, I would say, maybe 5 to 10 common devices, and then whenever a surgeon wants to do something specific, we can tailor made it for him, yeah, or her.
When did you actually decide that you want to be a startup founder?
I don't remember exactly the startup founder part, but the field, it was definitely in high school. The last year where I did, I was doing science, technology, and I had a course in biology, and I was learning about the eye, and I thought, oh, it would be super cool to combine technology and medicine. And actually, I talked to people in terms of what is the best path to go into that direction. So of course, today, biomedical engineering is very known, but back then I was still hesitant between going to life science at EPFL. Microengineering was an idea, medicine.
So you were based, or still based in Geneva, right?
Yeah, I was still in Geneva. I grew up here. So I talked to a few people and I decided to go into microengineering, but very early on, after the starting the second year of my bachelor, there was a contest for taking a chip, and you had to develop a device, a product. So we had done a bracelet that has an accelerometer and gyrometer that if you move your hand, it recognizes the movement. So something that is very common today, but it was not 15 years ago. And we did this product and we did a super cool algorithm. We did all the layouts of the circuits, etc. And then we went to present to a jury. And we actually made it to the finals in China. So it was a very nice event. We were three of us. And when we presented to the jury, the first question they asked is, okay, can you show us your SWOT matrix? And can you tell us about your patents? And these are words I had never understood. And our entire presentation was about our algorithm and our circuit board, etc. And
I realized, how wonderful it is.
Yes. And I realized that these people in front of me know nothing and do not care about the technology. And they had all these business questions. So obviously we didn't win, but it was a great lesson because I realized there's an entire other world when you develop these devices. Is the technology is one part, it's important, but you have this entire other world of business. And so this is where I got interested. I took courses in pitching and business plan writing. And I think little by little, I realized that if I want to make an actual product that's going to help people, you need at one point to go through this process of doing a startup company.
And that was a wrist. And how did you end up in the brain?
So the brain was, again, for my main interest was always on the biology side. And then I wanted to work on the eye initially. And then it's more of an opportunity. At the end of my bachelor's, I looked into who does what in terms of professors. And it was just at the right moment where they created a new center in EPFL, what is called the Center for Neuroprosthetics. And there was only one professor that was doing hardware. Everyone else was doing more like, you know, surgery or, you know, biology or signal processing. And so Professor Stéphanie Lacour, which is the professor with who we developed this basically, was the only one who was working on really hardware. So she was not doing the eye, she was doing the brain, but it was the closest to what I wanted. And that's how the story began.
And then you straight on told her that, hello, I want to found a startup here.
More or less. It was very hard to reach her for doing a project during the summer. So eventually I was able to do a semester project or summer project in her lab. And then I did a master thesis abroad, thanks to her in Boston. And then that's at the point where I told her, look, I want to do a PhD, but I want to do a startup. And that was an advice I was told by someone else to be very straightforward from the beginning, that if you're doing a PhD, but with the ambition of doing a startup company, to make it clear from the beginning, just to make sure that you're aligned with your professor.
How did she take that?
No, I think she was quite eager and happy to support that. And I think she also understood that at one point, if she wants to bring these devices to the clinic and also to actually, you know, on the market, someone needs to do this work. So I think she was very, and she is still very supportive, as she's one of our co-founders now of the company.
Well, how did you choose what diseases you work on, what materials? Like, I mean, there are so many possibilities, right?
No, so, well, the technology, let's say material-wise, it was really what the lab had started working on before I joined. So I just took over this work. Interestingly enough, this technology, Stéphanie Lacour invented it 20 years ago in Princeton.
Oh, wow.
So that tells you, and it was not even intended for implants. It was intended for stretchable screens and stuff like that.
Why 20 years then? I mean, like, I can imagine we waited for something.
Yeah.
Like, for what? What was needed?
At first, as I said, the technology for stretchable gold was initially not thought for implants. It was thought for working on for stretchable screens and stuff like that, and soft transistors. And then when Professor Lacour started working here at EPFL, she had a very close collaboration with Grégoire Courtine, who is working on spinal cord implants for, you know, rehabilitation and for people who have lost, who are paralyzed. And so this collaboration triggered the use case, I think, of using these devices in the context of an interface for the nervous system. It was a spinal cord in this case. So already here, it was 2013, 2012, the technology was initially discovered in 2003. So already here, you've lost 10 years just to have by chance a work that is around, you know, what you want to do. And then, yeah, it goes iteratively. We started with a process that was very, very manual. We started in rats. We published this in 2015. And then once the technology was quite mature, it took another 4 years just for the company Neurosoft to really bring it to a medical grade with the manufacturing up to the point that it's ready for humans.
Well, what was the journey for you from the scientist? You already mentioned like, wow, we need some business plan.
Yes. It was interesting. It came naturally, I would say. I did a lot of different courses, pitches, talked to people. At first, sometimes you feel like an imposter in what you do because you're like, that's not my job or it's not what I need to do. I think the motto I say often is that it's kind of like fake it till you make it. I felt really like that. So at first you say, okay, you know what? I'm going to pretend that I know what I'm talking about. And eventually you learn. And so I took a lot of courses and I surrounded myself with people who knew more than me. For example, one company that really helped me out is called Aliva Neurotherapeutics. They are a startup in EPFL. And so the main founder, André Mercanzini, I had done an internship with him. I had continued working for them as a consultant. And so he provided a lot of advice. So really the journey was, you know, talking to people, and then little by little, if you repeat the same thing, you end up, you know, being comfortable with it. Yeah.
Look for inspiration or motivation? Is there anyone or anything that actually pushes you forward?
I mean, to be honest, the main part that pushes me forward is my main interest and what I'm doing. I think that the goal, I think, is a good goal to try to help these patients. I also have to say that I find it interesting, everything we have to do from a technological perspective, but also just building a business. So I think that's really a self-motivation just to learn all these things. So that's the main one. And then, of course, you know, I like looking at what others do, but I don't have like a specific role model, let's say. But I always try to, you know, pick from what I see around myself.
And so you have one product now available, or yes. Is it a couple?
So for now, nothing is on the market. We are working on two main products in the company. So the first one is the soft ECOG. So and hopefully we want to submit to the FDA next year to get market approval in the US. Now, the other product we want to work on is a bit more complex because the first product is just the electrode. But as you can imagine, if you want to do a system that is a bit more complicated, that can do more, it's not only the electrode. You have also all the electronics, the programming, the software. And so we want to develop a solution to treat severe tinnitus.
What's that? If you could explain.
Yes, I can tell you more about it. So basically, tinnitus is this ringing in the ear. I think all of us experience it after a loud concert at night where you have this buzzing sound in your ear. And for some patients, for some people, this is constant. And for some of them, it's not only constant, but it's very, very loud. So it becomes to the point which is very debilitating. There's a huge comorbidity with depression, which also leads to high suicide rates. So it can be a very terrible disorder. So interestingly, about 14% of the general population has tinnitus.
That's pretty high.
It's pretty high. And to be honest, I've seen the statistics on literature, but I have, by experience, I would say that it's correct.
Oh.
When I talk to people, I would say about 15% of them tell me, oh, well, you know what? I have tinnitus. But only 1% of these patients about have very severe cases, which is really chronic and loud. And the problem is that there's no cure for this. Today, there's no treatment for tinnitus. There's management. Like I've had tinnitus for 6 months, for example, a few years ago due to stress, I would say mostly. And at night, it's horrible because you cannot sleep. So, but it's easy. At least it was easy for me to just put a fan on that has this white noise and covers it up. So a lot of the solutions are around these type of things.
So it's about covering really the internal noise with some outside noise.
So that's one of the most common methods. The other one is more, it's more about learning how to live with it. So cognitive behavioral therapy. So there's a lot of work. I would say that's the gold standard today. But there's no treatment. And people who are developing treatments, they work a lot on the periphery, meaning on the issue at the level of the ear. And the problem is that a lot of the research in the past few years have shown that in some of these patients, it starts from a peripheral problem. It could be a very loud noise or exposure to noise that causes tinnitus, but it actually creates changes inside the brain. And it becomes what we call a central disorder. And so this is where we thought it's interesting because in some patients, the root cause of the issue is within the brain. And so this is where a brain interface approach makes sense. And so this is kind of our approach for these patients.
So you create an implant again.
Yeah.
That would switch the noise off?
Pretty much. You can think of it like a volume knob, a button. Of course, we don't know what can be exactly the results expected, but people have tried in the past to stimulate some regions of the brain. Some cases, they can reduce the loudness sensation or other times completely suppress it. So you have a very wide range of effects. And so for us, we spent a lot of time and we're still working with experts, including one in our team who works with us to really understand which are the patients we have to select, what is the best approach, which is the target, how do we stimulate. But yes, and the idea is to indeed reduce or ideally completely suppress the sound.
So this first product, so the implant, ECOG implant, is almost ready, right? You are...
Almost, yeah.
Right. You are waiting for basically submit to the FDA.
Yes.
And the second one, like, when do we may expect it?
Yeah, I think from now, it might take another 5 years to have it on the market. But ideally, I would like within the next year or so, 12 to 18 months, to start our first trial, proof of concept.
What can be, now in general, What can be the challenges, you know, for implants like that?
Oh, there's a lot. Mm. I mean, I would say, well, technically speaking, when you put an implant that stays in the body for long term, you're not completely sure it's going to stay functional. So you want to make sure that your materials are robust and that they can really, you know, work very long time. So that's the first technical challenge. Then you have the clinical challenge. Okay, how are you going to stimulate? Where are you going to stimulate? What is the shape of the implant? So these are the type of questions we have to answer. Then you have one thing that I was told is I know a company that went bankrupt, not because they had a bad product, but they had bad criteria for patient selection in their trials. So that's something that is, especially for tinnitus, that's the feedback we've had, is that it's going to be very, very, very important to make sure that we select the right patients. Because we know that for some patients, there's no hope that it's going to work. And for others, they're going to be the ideal patients.
And also, like, I'm just thinking, I read some time ago about the company that did some brain implants and then they went bankrupt. And then what with the patients with the implants?
That's another question. Yeah. So there's a lot of these type of problems. So, no, that's an interesting question, and a lot of things are being discussed. And actually, I was thinking, that's a question I had even before doing neural implants, in general with implants. What do you do if the company does not exist anymore? So you want to make sure that you have a process in place at the very least to be able to follow these patients or remove the implant if needed. But yeah, so these are the type of challenges that we're going to face. And then, of course, you know, market challenges, financing the company, all of these other things.
And like the acceptance from the surgeons?
Yeah.
Have you surveyed it in any way? Like how would they
exactly
approach it?
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time with key opinion leaders, talking to neurosurgeons, ENTs, patients, patient associations, to understand how they perceived an invasive, let's say, approach to this problem. So that's why we decided to go into there, because we realized that not everyone, of course, is willing to get brain surgery for this, but there's definitely a big market for that. And so this is a lot of the work we do now.
How do you see now, you know, now I want to open up like a very general question. Yeah. How do you see this future of brain implants? Like, when are we touching the science fiction of what can we do with the brain?
It's an interesting question. So I think for now, people overestimate what we can do with the brain, with the implants. It's very, very crude. I mean, you don't see it, but when we are able to detect what that person is trying to say and who is paraplegic, this is typically what you would see. There's a team of 50 PhDs working with the algorithms trying to make this work. So it's really complex today, and we are not able to do a lot. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see a lot of medical applications for sure. I think it's going to be really focused for severe disorders. But I think this will serve as a platform to show, look, these devices not only are helping these patients, but they're relatively safe. It works well. And I think this is going to open up the market, meaning that patients who are maybe not very severe will still accept it. Because again, you know, why take, people are much more eager to take a pill than to put an implant. But, you know, if you think about it, a drug can be very, very bad for you and less than an implant. So it's more about a, you know, cultural thing to get used to these things.
I'm just thinking, you know, if you, because it's still something, you know, like a work on the brain.
Yes.
A burr hole doesn't sound this scary as probably does the opening up of the skull.
Yeah.
And like then again, we're thinking like, for how long do we keep it there? Yes. Like if it is forever, awesome, right? Yeah. If we need to change it like every 6 months or like change the battery or whatever, we may think twice, right?
No, there's a lot of questions like that. And for example, for the Parkinson device, the stimulator is actually put on the chest. And already here, there's two type of batteries now. There's the batteries that you have to replace every 5 years, but you don't have to open up the brain. You just do an incision on the pectoral muscle and you just change the battery. Or now there are the systems where you have to recharge it. So by induction. So it's like your phones where you just put like a device on top of your chest and it recharges. But you have to do that every week. So then it's up to the patients to say, okay, you know what? I'd rather do a small surgery every 5 years or have to recharge my device every week. So that's the type of questions that you have to ask yourself. And I think it comes to personal preferences. But I still think that in general, the field is going to remain very medical at the beginning.
And Neurosoft, where do you see it in like the future, say 10 years, 20 years, yeah. You know, like how would you like it to develop?
So for sure, I mean, we want to, the main goal of what we're doing is to establish our technology as something that is reliable, that is safe to both stimulate and record from a hardware perspective. And then within starting the next 5 to 10 years, I want to transition more towards the other part, which is the data. Because I think today the reason why we are not as advanced as other fields is because we lack data, but we lack data because we don't have the devices to gather them. So I think it makes sense today to focus on the hardware, to really have the best hardware, minimally invasive, high resolution, safe, that does not cause issues, that is stable. And once we get to that point, I think the next stage will be to leverage, you know, all the things that we know today with AI, machine learning. I think there's huge potential. Even I, who have lost a bit connection with what's happening on the AI machine learning side, and I'm trying to catch up now, I'm impressed with what we're able to do once we have a lot of data. And so for me, once we have a lot of data for brain-computer interfaces, I think it will improve a lot the therapies, what we can do. And I think that's, for me, will be the future stage of the company once we get there.
And in terms of like companies' needs, yeah. Like what do you need now? Like how yeah. do you want to, I can imagine, grow?
I mean, I would say the main things, as usual, is funding, especially today with the crisis you know, on the stock market and also with investors, especially for Class 3 implantable medical devices that have a long time to market. It's extremely difficult moment to find funding and find people who, you know, have the vision long term. They still exist, but it's not as easy as it was maybe 3 years ago. So for us, that's really the main need, because we already have a very good team. We already have great partners. Of course, there's still, you know, little things here and there that we're looking for partners for commercialization. But I would say funding is really a key aspect, especially for hardware that is costs a lot of money to develop.
Yeah. Can you actually say anything about like the range? How much does it cost to like manufacture yeah. it, or like how... Yeah, what could be the range of the prices?
So typically when you think about a device that is implanted permanently with the entire system, like a pacemaker type of system, then these systems can range in the US, let's say, between $25,000 and $45,000 for the full system. The electrode would typically more be on the range of $5,000. And then for these electrodes that are only used for a few days, a few weeks, it's more around $1,000 plus or minus.
So it's not awfully expensive as I would expect.
No, but you have to keep in mind that you also need a surgery. So it's not, yeah. yes, which yeah, also adds up to the cost. So it's not only the device, you also have to, you know, reimburse the entire procedure.
All right, Nicola. So, well, thank you very much for this fascinating, really, conversation about the brain and about how we can heal the brain while stimulating it yeah. or actually listening to it too, right?
Yes.
Thank you very much. And you guys, if you want to see, you know, where Neurosoft is now or what they develop now, please go to neurosoft-bio.com, which is neurosoft-bio.com. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the Exhale Show, leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.